Welcome, Dumbheads, to this week's Megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one episode per day, identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Heroes Unlimited, the gloriously ramshackle superhero RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the week's previous episodes in one Megasode, like this one. If you'd like to play along at home, we're reading Heroes Unlimited Revised Second Edition, second printing, from December 1998. Today we're discussing page 348 of Heroes Unlimited. We're in the equipment section. We've been working our way through, day by day and page by page, through some very dubious decisions about things to put in this book. We started right off the bat with the absence of firearms, and then after a few pages of transdimensional TMNT, which we talked about to pass the time while Heroes Unlimited retread a lot of already printed material about armor, optics, communication systems, surveillance devices, etc., we then came back strong with the portable scan dilator and the portable laboratory, a couple of science-y gadgets, and then yesterday we talked about field equipment and, believe it or not, containers. Almost 40 full lines of prices for various kinds of casks, crates, jugs, and jars. Presumably because this game is from 1998, a time when if you were playing a heated game of Heroes Unlimited and it became really important to find out how much a 4-pint jar costs, there was nothing you could do. I mean, the internet had only been popular for like 2 years. There were only about a dozen websites, none of them jar-themed. There was no way to get this information. I mean, I guess you could send somebody to the corner store to go see how much jars cost. There's time to do that in between rounds of Palladium Combat, but you know how it is. You send somebody away from the gaming table to go down the street to pick up pencils for character sheets, or a rock star for somebody who worked the night shift last night. Next thing you know, they're gone for a full hour, and when they come back, they've got like a bucket of fried chicken. You don't want people leaving the gaming table for no good reason. You really need a resource at the table to tell you how much jars cost, and god damn it, Heroes Unlimited has your back. While the absence of firearms is puzzling, you cannot say that this section is lacking in equipment. There's so much equipment here, things you would never expect to be in this section. But the opposite is also true. That's what I want to talk about today. And there's never exactly an appropriate time to talk about something that isn't in Heroes Unlimited. I just kind of have to pick the spot that seems best. And I picked today because this is the page where it occurred to me how much is missing from this equipment section. And sort of the bias that reveals about what we're tracking and what we care about in this game. So this page, first of all, continues a category entitled Miscellaneous Equipment, and boy howdy is it miscellaneous. We've got four more flashlights on this page. That brings us to a total of 5 flashlights, 4 strengths of padlock, a machete, wire cutters, trail rations, aviator sunglasses, an answering machine, a jetpack, nylon cord. Are these things in any particular order, you may ask? Alphabetical? Maybe divided into subcategories? Nope. Just whatever order they occurred to the author. He wrote the entry for spacesuit, and then he was like, oh yeah, shit, nylon cord. Nylon cord, also. And then he wrote a description for the nylon cord. No need to be any more specific than modem up with the computer equipment. But when it comes to nylon cord, quote, a variety of heavy-duty, all-purpose nylon rope or cord is available. Average tension strength is 600 pounds, and then in parentheses, 2,670 newtons. Average length is 300 feet. Cost, about $100, good availability. Everything you ever wanted to know about nylon cord. Tension strength listed in pounds and newtons? This is some serious detail. And then after the miscellaneous equipment, we get acids, and then we go on to specialty clothing. Specialty clothing is where something began to occur to me. The very first item, police-style jumpsuit. Bring to mind, please, a police-style jumpsuit. Imagine a person in a police-style jumpsuit. Okay, got it? I think you probably do. But Heroes Unlimited is not prepared to offer you that level of trust. Knowing you, you bonehead, you dunce, you need details. So here we go. Quote, one piece, zipper down the middle, large zippered chest pockets, 2, front pockets, 2, rear pockets, 2, pencil slash pen slot, left arm, sleeves and leg cuffs, zipper for adjustability, by swing, pleated back, and padded knees. Cost $130. I remind you that on the last page, this game did not see fit to explain the contents of a bow hunter accessory kit with the assumption that we would just know. But here on this page, it tells us that a police-style jumpsuit has a bi-swing pleated back and literally enumerates its pockets. We even get fashion choices. We even get color choices for many of these. Next up, heavy camouflage coveralls. Quote, insulated lining for cold weather, above freezing level cold, wrist and ankle elastic for tight fit, 6 pockets, chest, hip, rear. Tiger stripe camouflage, $90. Tree bark camouflage, $95. Black or white, $75. green, $75. So two types of camo and then three color choices in solids. We get similar options for the light camouflage coveralls. And by the way, this page has a 3D camouflage suit that has, quote, approximately 250 individual hanging strips to blend into the foliage, and it only gives a plus 10% to the prowl skill. So the strong implication is that all this other camo bullshit has no effect. I mean, if a $150 3D camo suit with like decoy leaves hanging off it only gives a plus 10% bonus, and that bonus is listed specifically, to me that implies that the rest of this camo is just for flavor. If it gave a small bonus, like a plus 5% bonus to prowl, it would be listed. Now this section goes on to give a lot of other useful garb that I have no problem having it in this game. Lab coats, you know, extreme weather gear. The decisive moment for me, the moment that I realized what was going on here and like realized what I was missing in this section, is when I got to wool sweaters, which actually appear on the next page. Quote, finest British quality knit with leather reinforcements at shoulders, elbows, and neck. Available in cream, green, or black. Cost $130 to $160. The wool sweater seemed way out of place to me until I realized that it's like a military style wool sweater. It's like what the Brigadier wears sometimes on Doctor Who. And then I realized this seemed out of place initially because virtually everything here is for like weirdo survivalists and military personnel. I mean, this section has fatigues, ghillie suits, tents, rations, wild animal traps, fishing line, there's a camouflage paint kit, lots of cord and rope and chains and canvas. And this all kind of seems reasonable until you consider, when's the last time you saw a comic book superhero with a giant stockpile of military gear? I mean, barring a character like The Punisher or Deathstroke or somebody who that's their gimmick, which in this game would be like the Hunter Vigilante character or the Hardware Weapons character. I'm talking about your Superman, your Spider-Man, your Wonder Woman, your Hulk, your Martian Manhunter, the X-Men. I mean, they've got gear, they've got some equipment, but like how many of them wear police jumpsuits? How many of them wear fatigues, make heavy use of camouflage spray paint, have kits complete with mosquito netting and fishing line and rabbit traps? How many superheroes routinely carry rations? Yes, I know Batman carries snacks in his utility belt. Everybody knows that. It's the funniest fact about Batman. Because you know those snacks need to be highly compact, so it stands to reason that some of those little, like, yellow vial-looking things, those little narrow compartments on Batman's utility belt, are full of, like, peanuts and cashews. It's hilarious. But most superheroes don't do that. Most superheroes don't carry trail rations. Soldiers do, adventurers do, but not superheroes. This equipment section is really for soldiers. I think partly out of a misguided sense of realism of like what would a superhero actually want in the field if they were running their superhero career like kind of one-man paramilitary operation. And partly it's simply probably laziness from the fact that the game Recon exists, you know, Palladium's Vietnam War game. It has an equipment list. Therefore, we get, as we discussed in season one, like Vietnam era battlefield radios just reprinted in the equipment section of subsequent Palladium books. Because why wouldn't you? We wrote it. Why wouldn't it be in every book going forward? That's leaving money on the table. You know what isn't in this section? And the wool sweater is what made me realize this. Because when I saw it, it suddenly like opened my mind to this whole dimension of things that I hadn't seen in this section previously. There are no civilian clothes in this section. You know, there are police jumpsuits and ghillie suits and lab coats and fatigues. But other than that wool sweater, possibly, there are no like regular people clothes. Not even in broad strokes, like one formal outfit or work clothes. Nothing. No clothes except like soldier slash adventurer slash police clothes. Other than military rations, there's no food in this section. So if like most superheroes, you prefer to either eat at restaurants or buy groceries and make food at home, you're out of luck. This equipment section provides two ways to feed a superhero: military rations or trapping and fishing like Grizzly Adams. Speaking of restaurants, there are no services listed in this section at all. You know, going out for a meal, staying at a hotel, getting transport on like an airplane or a bus, anything from taking the subway in New York to taking a jet to Hong Kong, nothing. No listing. Nothing about information resources. There's nothing here about books, subscription services for journal access for scholarly characters, internet connection, ancient magical tomes, nothing here about information resources at all. Headquarters, right? Superheroes very commonly have headquarters, anything from like the Batcave to an apartment with a secret room behind the walk-in closet. Nothing here about real estate, about workshops, about lab facilities, holding cells, nothing. Costumes? Nothing. I mean, if you're lucky and you're, you know, a magical superhero and you can make your own magical costume, whenever you say your magical word, then good for you. Or if you happen to have a superpower like bio armor that functions as a costume, then great. But if you're like most superheroes, you got to have that awkward moment after you've realized that you have great responsibility and before you bust your first supervillain, where you got to figure out where to get a spandex onesie so that your weird lifestyle won't put your family in danger. This equipment section's got nothing for you. No costumes in a superhero game. And okay, lots of superhero games don't have rules about costumes. You know what else they don't have? Prices and volume measurements for four different kinds of glass jar. I mean, when you really think about it, superheroes and comic books have pretty varied budgets, right? While Bruce Wayne is paying Alfred, maybe buying jewelry for Selina Kyle, and at the same time trying to orchestrate a takeover of some evil Gotham corporation, meanwhile, Peter Parker is trying to pay his tuition, struggling with rent for his New York apartment, maybe saving up to buy his Aunt May a nice hat for her birthday. You got characters supporting alcohol addictions, paying informants, paying out of pocket for confidential medical care, gambling, hiring lawyers, collecting rewards for turning in wanted criminals. It's like every kind of comic book hero has financial and equipment considerations that aren't even broadly touched on by this section. But we do get, for example, separate entries for the pants and shirt components of battle dress uniforms, each of which is subdivided into the categories of tiger stripe, tree bark, SWAT black, olive green, white, or khaki. They really fucking slipped one by us here. I did not notice this as a kid. But this is not a superhero game equipment section. This is the equipment section for some kind of urban paramilitary bullshit. This is like Death Squad the role-playing game. Which makes me wonder if the heroes at Kevin Sambita's table operated this way? Like, did they set up camouflaged areas in the city and like burst out of it with their machine guns, camouflage paint all over their faces, and a pile of, you know, bug out bags with wilderness survival equipment in case the supervillain encounter goes south? Is that how people played this game? Or did this just run like a superhero game and they just kind of glossed over the question of equipment so that when it came time to actually turn this into a book, they just filled the equipment section with shit they had lying around from other games in the Palladium Books line? I really don't know, but I think the dumbest thing, if I had to pick one thing on this page, is the specialty clothing section. Granted, it only starts on this page, but it really encapsulates my larger point that applies to this whole page, which is that if you're gonna have a special clothing section in a superhero game, to have it focus literally exclusively on police and military garb, and not even touch on civilian clothes or superhero costumes, it's just a weird-ass choice, and like a very beardy grognard one, to say, okay, we're gonna write the clothing section. Obviously, no clothes matter except what soldiers wear, so we'll just gloss over all normal clothes and all superhero clothes in this superhero game, and let's just really take a tight focus on what colors of camo you can get for each individual item of military dress. I'm buying my cold weather coveralls now. Do I want the forest camo or the Arctic camo? This is the kind of decision we always see Peter Parker struggling with. You know, if there's really one perennial struggle Aquaman has had in adapting to the surface world, it's, shall I opt for a khaki wool sweater for this operation or the cream wool sweater? It's just so out of genre. Just page after page of stuff that you couldn't give a shit less about in a superhero game. Speaking of things we all couldn't give less of a shit about, tomorrow we're on to yet more repeated content from Ninjas and Super Spies, and you know what that means. Join me tomorrow as we don't quite talk about the final page of the equipment section on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 349 of Heroes Unlimited. This is just about the end of the equipment section, except for the upcoming two-page illustrated ancient weapons table or catalog or whatever. This is the last page of the main body of the section, and I wish I could give it a big send-off, but appropriately for this section that had no room for firearms, it ends conspicuously without a bang. All that's here is the end of the clothing section, which we discussed yesterday, pretty much just military and police outfits, plus the odd lab coat or poncho. Then we got some hats, and then we got a small list of conventional vehicles, cars and trucks and that sort of thing. We've really talked about most or all of this before in Ninjas and Super Spies, and you know what that means. Instead of giving a big send-off to the equipment section, we're going to celebrate the silent death this section deserves by turning away from it now to discuss the most wonderful thing on a random page of Transdimensional TMNT, a book that has mutant animals, psychic powers, time machines, dimensional travel, adventures, NPCs, and still has room for guns, so suck it, Heroes Unlimited. I'm rolling the dice now. And hey, speak of the devil. This is page 63, which is a page full of guns. These are period firearms, flintlock rifles and pistols from the 1700s. Just in case you travel back to that time period, maybe American Revolutionary War period, want to do a little bit of dueling, some Minutemaning, or redcoating, depending on where your sympathies lie, and so you need some stats for pistols. Now, we've talked before, when we've talked about transdimensional TMNT, about the rules for period firearms. So I'm not going to repeat that today. And they're not on this page anyway. They're on the previous page. That's where we learn like how these weapons work, you know, what a flintlock is, and how you load and fire one, for those who might not be up on their 18th century gun tech. This page is just a list of the weapons. Having explained what a flintlock is, now we just get the game stats for individual weapons. Now, you'll pardon me if I stray slightly from this individual page, because this is actually a really good opportunity to talk about guns done right in a Palladium game. It would have been possible. I mean, we don't need a million flintlocks necessarily, right? You could run a period adventure, especially because this is a time travel game that kind of goes everywhere. So if you wanted, you could have just done one high-level sort of like, this is what a flintlock pistol is like, and then there's a bunch of different kinds. But no. In order to make adventures in this time period more flavorful, we actually get a list of weapons. But the space is used really effectively. The detail is really meted out effectively. The information we get is information that is good for gaming and makes the game more fun. That's how you make room for guns in a game that's loaded with other stuff. Unlike in, say, Ninjas and Super Spies, which had a voluminous firearm section, because there had to be a separate illustration for every single weapon, here we just get a couple of interesting ones. Like, there's a picture of a blunderbuss, captioned as such, up at the top of the page. A blunderbuss is a gun I've heard of, and I don't know one fucking thing about guns, as those of you who do will no doubt have noticed. What a great way to open a page, for a dumbass like me. It's like when a cool band that's had a whole career but everybody just knows the one radio song has a concert. You start with the song that everybody's heard. You start with the one song the dumbasses know, so they can kind of ease into you, you know? Or like how in Barbarella, they start out by getting Jane Fonda naked so that, if that's what you're there for, we can just scratch that itch right away rather than being distracted the whole movie waiting for it. So that's nice for some viewers. Or, you know, some of the time. Like, I've watched Barbarella a number of times with many different motivations. I'm not on trial here. My point is, it's nice to start with an illustration of a thing we know what it is that is interesting to the layman. Then we don't need more pictures of, to the untrained eye, very similar looking firearms for the rest of the page. Most of these stat blocks don't get an illustration, and that's fine. It makes room for them. We can have all these guns rather than having to cut half of them to make room for pictures of the other half. Once we get onto the stat blocks, we start with flintlock rifles. We get four flintlock rifles. They are well selected, and the game tells us what we need to know about them. For example, we start with the 75 caliber Brown Bess flintlock musket. Quote, the standard weapon of the American Revolution, it was used in British colonies the world over. And then we get a standard stat block. It's going to be the same for all of these, with country of origin, caliber, feed, weight, barrel length, overall length, effective range, damage, and cost, which is actually the cost for a modern replica of the weapon, which is an interesting choice. I guess the idea is if you're going to go back to the American Revolutionary War and fight with the Minutemen, you're either going to get your rifle and your tricorn hat from actual Minutemen, or you're going to buy your equipment back home. You're not going to do a shopping trip in the past at ye olde gun shop, which is interesting. I don't know that that's necessarily the right or the wrong way to run a historical adventure, although the idea of not shopping while I'm on my time travel journey does appeal to me. In any case, the only two things in the stat block that we could maybe lose would be like the barrel length and the weight. Many tables will want to know that, many won't, so it's a toss-up. Everything else here, though, is very solid. We need to know caliber, feed, overall size, range, damage. Those are the things we need to know to run these weapons. Plus, country of origin, which I think you might think you could cut, but you can't, because this is not only a shopping list for player characters, it's also a resource for GMs to equip their NPCs, right? So you need to know where these weapons come from and who uses them so that you can equip your forces accordingly. Speaking of, the next weapon we get, the 69 caliber French Charleville model 1763 flintlock. I don't know if Charleville is how you pronounce that word. I don't know anything about guns. Also, I don't know anything about French. Just one of the many reasons I would not personally want to travel back to the American Revolution. This is a weapon, it says, was used widely in the American Revolutionary War and, quote, imitated by the U.S. with the model 1795. So we don't need another stat block for it. We just know if you want to make a model 1795, use these stats. After that, we get two more weapons. The 50 caliber Kentucky flintlock long rifle, quote, the most famous weapon of the U.S., popularized by Daniel Boone and countless American pioneers. So famous gun, famous dude, sort of a landmark of the historical period. You put his weapon in the game. Sure. And then finally, the 32 caliber flintlock squirrel rifle. Quote, a good lightweight flintlock hunting rifle. commonly used since the introduction of flintlocks and still used by modern hobbyists. This is a gun from the US. It does less damage than the others. It's a hunting rifle, and it says it's still used today. You might think, why not cut this one because it's inferior to the others? I'll tell you why. You don't just need to have the best guns. If you had to make cuts, then sure, cut the stuff that player characters wouldn't pick. But you get four rifles here. You've already hit three popular combat-worthy weapons that different forces in the conflict would use. By throwing in a hunting rifle, you're giving me a weapon to equip NPCs with who aren't soldiers. You know, if there's some Revolution-era rando and we roll up on his homestead trying to steal some Revolution-era trench coats and fedoras to hide our hideous mutant appearance, you know, we're out there on the clothesline pulling down the Revolution-era clothes, and then somebody starts shooting a rifle at us from the farmhouse, it's nice that that's not a soldier's rifle. It's a hunting rifle. And if we go tackle that dude and steal his weapon, which of course we will, for some value of tackle, depending on our alignment, then now we've got an inferior rifle and we might want to trade up later once we, you know, join up with a military unit or take down some soldiers or whatever. So this rifle earns its place because it's for a thing that's likely to come up. As much as I like the rifles though, the pistols are the better things on this page. The whole right-hand column, we just get flintlock pistols, and they're similarly well-chosen. Each one has this little blurb. I'm not going to give you all the stats for these, or the names, with which I could further embarrass myself, but each one gets a blurb that helps explain like why it's in the game, and why it's interesting, which I really appreciate if you're going to take up the space for the gun, which provides a lot of information that your typical gun enthusiast may already know. So really, these stats are, in large part, for dumbasses like me. It's useful to tell me, like, why should I care? That's a really good use of space that justifies the space you use for the mechanical implementation of the weapon. For example, this Model 1777, quote, a common pistol from the American Revolutionary War era. Along with the Charleville Model 1763 musket, many were provided to Washington's troops by their French allies. So we get a French weapon again that's commonly used by Washington's troops. We might easily be working with Washington's troops, and we might get our hands on some of these weapons when we fight alongside General Washington. That seems like a very time-travel American Revolutionary War thing to do. So great. Without the blurb, it's just a pistol. But with the blurb, it suggests an adventure. We also get a pistol commonly used by pioneers. We get another pistol for pirates, the 50 caliber London flintlock pistola. Quote, the classic naval pistol from the Age of Pirates, used by navies throughout the world, and pirates like to carry a brace of loaded pistolas for increased firepower. What a great use of space this is! And it tells me what it's for. I don't have to guess, like that World War II pistol that made its way into Ninjas and Super Spies somehow, where I had to go, you know, Google what this weapon is and what its history is to figure out why it's here. Here, it tells me straight up. This is the pirate pistol. This is the pistol you give to pirates. In fact, give a pirate a bunch of these pistols preloaded so they can, like, pull one off their little brace of pistols, fire it, toss it aside, grab another one, because that's how pirates fight. This is an adventure hook. It's a combat tactic. It's an NPC idea. And it's a stat block. A great use of space. We get another flintlock pistol where there's a note, quote, one of the primary weapons used in the American Revolutionary War and by Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans. In the 1900s, many were modified to use percussion caps. So this is a weapon that's from earlier in history, but later on, it was modified for the latest weapons technology. So maybe, you know, if I got one of these in an earlier adventure, it could be modified to fire percussion caps if we travel to a later period. Or I might have an NPC who's from the old days who has one of these things still, even though we're on to percussion cap times now. So again, super useful. My favorite one on this page, though, and I'm going to say the most wonderful thing, is the flintlock dueling pistol. Quote, an upper-class weapon designed for formal dueling, but a common gift for the, quote, noble who has everything. Presidents Washington and Jefferson each owned a similar set of pistols. This gets all the standard stats, and then under cost it says, quote, $900 for a pair of modern replicas. Includes a fancy case with tools for cleaning and disassembling the pistols, along with an oil bottle, cleaning brush, leather-covered gunpowder flask, and a loading rod. I'm gonna sound like a real hypocrite after what I said about the firearm accessories earlier in the equipment section in Heroes Unlimited, saying that I really like this detail. But here's the thing, this is intentional game design. We don't need to know what kind of shoulder strap is attached to these other rifles, and it doesn't tell us. We don't need to know anything about, like, the finish of the wood on these things. We don't need a lot of detail about flintlock accessories, and we don't waste space on those things. We get the extra detail here because of what these weapons are and what they're for. A thing that the author knows, setting this game miles and ages apart from Heroes Unlimited. The other weapons are for shooting in a combat situation, like on a battlefield. They're general purpose weapons to equip your character for doing battle in this time period. So you need to know the damage, you need to know the range, etc., etc. These are the fancy guns. These dueling pistols, are for formal duels, and they're like status symbols. They're given as gifts to nobles. President Washington has a pair. Maybe he would give them as a gift to our characters if we save his life. Or, if we decide to kill President Washington, we could claim his dueling pistols as our own. Or, we could recruit him to the party, like it's goddamn Kingdom Hearts, and he can use his trademark dueling pistols alongside us in battle. In any case, these are like spotlight weapons, and not because they do so much damage, but because they're like a plot point. These are fancy-ass treasure or like signature weapons of a special NPC. Therefore, it's cool that they come with like a kit of accessories. Kind of makes them stand out. And if you're going to drop $900 on these things for a replica, or kill George Washington for the original, then you want the whole kit, and that's fantastic. Without the blurb, this is uninteresting, bordering on wasted space. With the blurb, we've got, once again, an idea for historical NPCs to drop into your campaign, an idea for an interesting combat scenario, a formal duel instead of an all-out fight. We've got great treasure. So instead of bailing on this because space is limited and saying, we're just not going to do guns, instead we get a few well-chosen guns, each one given exactly what it needs to justify its existence. When your gun stats are not just for equipping characters, but are adding to the fun of the campaign and the scenario, you know you're doing something right. And this game definitely is. I've never had George Washington fighting alongside me as a player character, but now that I have it in my mind, it's on my bucket list. Join me tomorrow as Heroes Unlimited rattles off some ancient weapons that we've already seen in Ninjas and Super Spies, and you know what that means, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 350 of Heroes Unlimited. What's on this page? Well, I refer you to the inscription in stone at the top of this page that says Ancient Weapons. That's right, it's a big illustrated list of ancient weapons. From axes, to polearms, to spears, to more goddamn knives. This page was in Ninjas and Super Spies. It is of ancient lineage. This, like, fourth-hand photocopy of a page, presumably originally from Palladium Fantasy, has been published in many, many Palladium books. And, you know, if you want to buy a Vulge, or a Runka, or a stone axe, this is the place for you. But we've already talked about this. So let's turn away from these polearms, and these additional identical knives, and instead, once again, discuss the most wonderful thing on a random page of Transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm rolling the dice now. So that's a 30. This is the beginning of the skill list and skill descriptions for the new skills introduced in Transdimensional TMNT. Now, this is a time travel game, so it needs to have historical skills. We've talked before about the Time Traveler skill package that's offered in this game. There are actually a number of different packages for time travelers that are useful skills to know if you're someone who travels in time. I'm going to try to stay away from the points that I made back then and instead talk about the individual skills that are offered, because this page has got a list of those individual skills. I really like a number of these skills and the way that they're presented. First of all, there's a number of specific history skills that talk about different time periods, and the skill descriptions note what's happening in those time periods and what weapons are commonly used, making skill selection a little easier, right? I'm an expert in 18th century history. What guns do I need to know about? Oh, it says right here, this is the Age of Flintlock guns. There's also a note that the Ancient Civilizations history skill tells you about recorded history, but not all history is recorded. A lot of it isn't during that period. So while you know things about Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Babylonian, Egyptian, Phoenician, Greek, and Persian civilizations, there are a lot of things that simply aren't on the record and therefore you don't know them. Great little detail there. I also appreciate the minimum strength to learn the blacksmith skill. I appreciate the flint working ability. This is like one of those historical skills that a lesser game might be inclined to write off as like primitive, like these are unskilled people. Whereas here, it gives the flint workers the respect that they deserve. It's hard to make an obsidian arrowhead, the soft-handed podcast host said, as though he had just dragged a bison home to feed his family. I mean, I presume it's hard to make an obsidian arrowhead, and I appreciate that the game treats skills as skills, is my point. My favorite skill here, though, and it's not described on this page, but, you know, we're not going to talk about a ton more Transdimensional TMNT because the season is almost over, and it's listed on this page. It's on the list of skills which are introduced here, so I think it's fair game. My favorite skill is paleontology. For the amount that dinosaurs show up in role-playing games in the most unlikely scenarios, like on the top five list of things that show up places they shouldn't be in role-playing games because gamers like them, it's got to be, in no particular order, zombies, magic swords, taverns, personal hygiene, and dinosaurs. But for all that they show up everywhere, rarely do you find an actual skill for dealing with dinosaurs, especially like a skill anybody can take as opposed to like a class feature, you know, where somebody's a dinosaur rider and therefore they can, you know, dinosaur whisper or whatever. But here, It's a real, useful scientific skill because you can go to time periods with dinosaurs. Quote, study of prehistoric life through the examination of ancient bones and fossils. A successful role means the character can identify the species and time period of any prehistoric animals, including dinosaurs. Character also has an immediate chance of identifying the time period of any particular prehistoric era simply by observing local vegetation. This is brilliant. This last part is brilliant. If you've been paying attention to the coverage of Transdimensional TMNT throughout the season, you know that the way time travel works is that you can only like time travel to specific eras readily. So like the 18th century period that we talked about yesterday, that's one period, and then another one would be like dinosaur times. But there are multiple versions of dinosaur times, separated by millions of years. The times you can travel to are clustered closer together, closer to the present, and then there's more distance between them in the far past. What this means is that paleontology becomes a useful skill for identifying what time period you're in, because there's enough distance between the prehistoric junctures, so to speak, the periods you can visit, that the flora is different enough that a trained paleontologist would be able to use it to figure out when the group has traveled to. It's so organic, and yet it's such a brilliant way to make this skill useful, even if the group's not getting attacked by dinosaurs, which, I mean, it's going to happen eventually, and you build your character, and you know, you create a paleontologist adventurer in anticipation of befriending slash being attacked by a dinosaur. Could be one or the other, could be both, maybe it depends on how you play your cards. But unless your game is a sort of like dating sim for dinosaurs where you just meet an endless succession of dinosaurs and either piss them off or become their best friend, and I'm not saying don't do that, but unless you do that, some of your sessions, some of your time travels, there won't be any dinosaurs necessarily around. And even some of your trips to prehistory, you may not want to introduce a dinosaur attack right away as a GM. You may want to build some anticipation, right? This skill gives the paleontologist a way to contribute to the group, to get useful information, to feel like a scientist, to feel like, you know, I am our guide on our travels to the past, without having to drop in a dinosaur encounter right away. It's great. Like, I feel like a character with this skill would be a great Doctor Who companion, if Doctor Who had the budget to routinely go to dinosaur times, which it conspicuously doesn't. Like, given the Doctor's personality, given the Doctor's time machine, you would expect the Doctor to spend an awful lot of time running around looking at dinosaurs. The Doctor notably does not do this very often, and the production expense of doing dinosaur times stories is the only reason, as far as I'm concerned. Whenever we're not seeing the Doctor, like whenever the Doctor is off screen, I assume that the Doctor is playing with dinosaurs. But yeah, science skills are tricky. This is a really good one. It's useful, it's practical, it's not punishingly difficult. It's got a 40% base skill level plus 5% per level of experience. If you're an educated character with like a plus 15 to plus 20% bonus, then you've got a decent chance of success up front that will pretty rapidly rise through the early levels. So you get to be good at the thing that you're good at. Imagine that. Even though paleontology only appears on a list here on page 30 and the description comes later, I'm going to say that the inclusion of paleontology is the most wonderful thing on this page. Although, you know, there are lots of little things. Like, there's a note that if you have the history, Roman skill, you not only know Roman history, but you also have a basic understanding of Etruscan culture. What a wonderful little detail. The medieval history skill calls out that you have a knowledge of Muslim civilization as well as the traditional Eurocentric feudal knights and castles stuff. Really good reminder. It's an important thing to know about that time period. I like knights and castles too, but you know what? You go back to this period, Islamic societies are kind of the place to be. Even just something as simple as separating the riding skill from the teamster slash wagoner skill, just a nice little touch. But those are all little details the game gets right. Paleontologist is a character concept. That's a skill that's pulling its weight, so that's my favorite thing. Join me next time as Heroes Unlimited continues to blather on about medieval weapons, and you know what that means, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing page 351 of Heroes Unlimited. We are rapidly reaching the end of this book. We're on the second page of ancient photocopied illustrated weapon list. This book does close off with very out-of-place medieval weapons for this modern superhero game. And this is all stuff we've talked about before. Although I do want to point out, you got this big old list of weapons, right? Short swords, large swords, ball and chain, blunt weapons, right? We got all the stuff we talked about in Ninjas and Super Spies. The Hercules Club, aka the Morgenstern. The hardest working sword in show business, the Flamberge. The Cutlass, the Iron Staff. Then at the bottom, we got a bunch of miscellaneous weapons that are not necessarily medieval. Blackjacks, darts, bullwhips, meat cleavers, and frying pans. Then at the bottom of the list, in a noticeably different typeface, we get a little note. Quote, all weapons are of good to excellent, quote, combat quality. I don't know what this means. I mean, I guess it's like, these are not katanas that you buy to display in your shitty apartment. these are real katanas, real swords, real bows. I don't know really what to make of the meat cleaver and the frying pan, if that's the case. I'm not aware of people making war frying pans, although leave it to dwarves, I guess. This did come from a fantasy game. Anyway, a very minor point, a page that is mostly stuff we've talked about before, and by now, you've got to know what that means. It's time, once again, for the last time this season, to ignore this page of recycled content in Heroes Unlimited, and instead delve into a random page of transdimensional Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and talk about the most wonderful thing on that page. I'm rolling the dice now. All right, I've rolled a 65, and this is a gun page. More guns, which we just talked about. You know, it's my show. I'm breaking the rules. I'm rolling again. This is maybe my last chance on the podcast ever to convince you to go track down a copy of this book, to talk about the wonderful things within it. I don't want to talk about breech-loading guns. Let's try again. Okay, this is more like it. This is page 50, and it's actually a really good idea of sound design turned to gonzo purposes in Transdimensional TMNT, a proper send-off to this book, which has given us so much joy. This page lists the first of the temporal manipulation spells. These are the spells you can cast if you are a Time Lord, a magic user focusing on time. A magic user with flavor, imagine that. A special kind of magic user with a special kind of spells and an identity. But our unbelievable good fortune doesn't end there. We get a particular spell on this page, and like a number of them are good. Like, I could talk about the fact that you can use your magic to jump around, look into the past, go into other dimensions. Like, there are time-traveling wizards in this game, and it's well implemented, which is light years and regular years beyond what a Heroes Unlimited wizard can do, both in terms of power and in terms of flavor. But I want to focus on one particular spell, Temporal Energy Manipulation. Quote, this can be used as an attack or as a way of reversing TE changes. TE is temporal energy. I don't want to get into the whole thing, but just as a reminder, in this game, when something has moved from its home time, it can accumulate temporal energy, which can alter the thing. To continue, quote, in either case, for every melee round of effective contact, the spellcaster can manipulate 5 BioE points worth of TE mutations in a person or object. Subtracting the BioE can be done at any time, with a resulting devolution in the victim back to normal. Using temporal energy manipulation for the process of evolutionary mutation is only possible if the victim already has an excess of BioE. In other words, the character must already have moved into the future from his home time era. The effects are typically temporary, but there are some exceptions. For example, if you do it to an immature creature, there's an 80% chance that whatever effects you create are permanent. The important thing here is, first of all, this is great nonsensical sci-fi stuff. It's so at home in this game. I know this isn't how evolution works. Like, I understand you've got to be a particularly clueless sci-fi writer to do that thing where, like, you put a baby dinosaur in the time machine in the past, and then you go back to the present, and you're like, hey, everybody, we're home, but you accidentally left the dinosaur in the machine. And then when the dinosaur comes out, it's evolved because, like, so many millions of years have passed, and that's millions of years of evolution, which, in the hacky sci-fi writer's mind, is like unlockable content for your body that just all gets unlocked at once, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, fucking wings, and you're 10 times taller and super intelligent. Has no bearing on actual evolution. Nonetheless, this is such a great trope and a cool idea for such a weird game. Because if you're going to do time-traveling mutant animals, you want time to be able to mutate or unmutate them, right? It's a very natural fit. This spell drops that trope in the hands of a player character, which is bold and wonderful in its own right, and it does so by using the BioE system, right? The system of biological energy points that you use for character creation for mutant animals, and actually allowing the player to manipulate those points, to manipulate those numbers in play. I'm really relying on the overt effect of this spell for the gonzo factor here. I hope you are as impressed as I am by the idea of a wizard in a funny Time Lord hat extending his hand toward a mutant animal and evolving it or devolving it using temporal energy. It's super cool. But the gonzo here is not really what I'm excited about, to be perfectly honest with you. It's the fact that it's supported by such clever design. Well, I say clever. Palladium sets such a low bar, that's the thing. For another company, it wouldn't be unusual for someone to say, hey, I've got this spell I want to write, or this power I want to create. Does that have any connection to other rules that have already been written? Could I maybe work with a rules concept that already exists to create some kind of coherence to this system? In other companies, game lines, that would be standard practice. Here it comes as a revelation. Contrast with Blindwatch, where we have spells about the very simple concept of obscuring things from sight that just had to be like rewritten from scratch every time. Sometimes with whole new rules concepts, like a percentile chance to fall down every X number of feet that you travel, which like applies in some cases when you're blind and not in others, just for no reason, just because every time we talk about this, we just start completely from scratch. And as a result, lots of systems in Palladium games get thoroughly elaborated and then abandoned, like the monster bugs that we talked about, right? So many pages of giant bug stats, then later when giant bugs come up, it's like it never happened. Wasted space, wasted design, and incoherence, ultimately, right? If a wizard and a superhero both enlarge an ant from the same colony of ants, they've got different stats. It's like those two pages of the rulebook just aren't aware of each other. Here, though, the idea of turning BioE, which up to this point has been purely a character creation thing, into a feature of a character that you can manipulate with magic, mutating them in play, it's so cool. It's got that great mix that I love from Transdimensional TMNT of creativity but also coherence, mechanical soundness. Just fantastic. One more thing I have to mention before we leave this page. We've gotten a lot of fairly dull examples in the course of Heroes Unlimited. There's an example here of how to use the spell Time Peak, which allows you to look into the past in your current location. Here's the example of how it works. Quote, Petrovich, a fourth level Time Lord, discovers that the cookie jar in his kitchen is empty. Enraged that the last of his favorite almond shortbread squares are missing, he decides to cast a few Time Peak spells to discover the criminal. He thinks that perhaps this morning, when everyone was having breakfast, someone stole the cookies. Sitting down at the kitchen table, he casts a Time Peak back to 8 a.m. that morning. Looking out into an empty room, he realizes that he may have cast the spell for a time that was too early. He peers through the spell for a full 2 minutes while watching 2 minutes in the past from 8 to 8:02 a.m. The example goes on to describe Petrovich conducting a search of other times this morning, trying to find the culprit. We rejoin the example later. Quote, by now, Petrovich has cast 4 of the 8 spells he's allowed for the day. He decides that justice will have to wait. Over the next few days, Petrovich cast Time Peak spells into the cookie jar, gradually narrowing down the time when the theft took place. Eventually, he sees the hand stealing the cookies. Unfortunately, he's still got to cast yet one more Time Peak. Since he doesn't recognize the hand, he has to cast the next Time Peak looking at the area outside the cookie jar at the exact time of the event in order to discover the culprit. Such a fun example, such a fun scenario they've created. I love Petrovich waiting for justice. I love him casting 4 spells, like half his spell loadout in a single day, trying to figure out who stole the cookies and failing, and the example continues. I love the detail that he doesn't recognize the hand, because it raises the possibility that if he were, you know, betrayed in this by someone he really trusted, or, you know, a mutant animal, like if it was a mutant terror crane reaching in there with their talon-like claws to grab those almond squares, then Petrovich would have been all set. He would have clenched his fist and been like, ah, terror crane, you Judas. But because it was just a regular ass hand, he's got to cast one more time, extending the suspense. Just these little touches, just the flavor. Petrovich, in this handful of paragraphs, becomes more interesting than very much of what we read in Heroes Unlimited, like in that whole fat book. Just the occasional appearance of a compelling character would have really helped Heroes Unlimited to grab you. But you can't compare Heroes Unlimited to Transdimensional TMNT. That's not fair. While I love them both in different ways, you know, it's like you love your honor student, you also love your child who was expelled for unchecked pyromania. You may love them equally, but that doesn't mean you could equally recommend studiousness and pyromania to a friend. One of these things is not like the other. Clearly, Transdimensional TMNT is just in a different league in terms of a lot of aspects of game design from Heroes Unlimited. And this page is really a good example. Even when it comes to wacky, over-the-top stuff, which is sort of Heroes Unlimited's stock in trade, right there with Rifts, I would say, even when it comes to that stuff, Transdimensional TMNT has equally good ideas, better executed. With that said, we are done with Transdimensional TMNT, and we are almost done with Heroes Unlimited. Join me next time for the last page of Heroes Unlimited, although we still have a back cover to go, on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today, we've finally made it. Here we are, discussing page 352 of Heroes Unlimited, the last page of this book, although not the last episode of this season. There's still a couple more left. We've got a back cover, and we've got a little wrap-up to do. Nonetheless, this is a major milestone. 352. We've reached the last page of this book, a book that is not only incredibly long, like 352 pages seemed like a lot when I was just looking at this book squatting gargoyle-like upon my shelf, but when you open it up and you dig in, not only is this book 352 pages long, it is 352 long pages long. We have been up and down with a huge variety of topics in this book. It's much more of a mixed bag than Ninjas and Super Spies was. That book is really like one bizarre riff on the overlapping genres of martial arts and super spy fiction. It's weird but cohesive. This book has been extremely various. Some of these episodes have been really goofy. Some of these episodes have been a little more serious. Some of them have talked about, you know, high-flown ideas about game design. Others have been about pedantic details of editing. So it's really nice here on the final page to settle into a true classic of the bad RPG idea genre. You all know the tune to this chestnut, weirdly scaling and separate XP progression tables for different character classes. Or, you know, power categories. Can I just say, a little peek behind the curtain here. Over 352 pages, I've probably spent a solid 2 hours of my life calling the power categories character classes, then catching myself, saying it again, and then having to edit out the word character class later. That's the kind of attention to detail that I've given you for no reason over the past 352 pages. Just thought I'd put it out there. But yeah, call them power categories, call them character classes, call them what you will. They're different types of characters. Probably everybody at the table is going to have a different one because there are a bunch of them in this game. And unlike in most modern games and in even later editions of D&D, Palladium holds on to the old school practice of maintaining separate XP progression tables for each of the character types. So assuming that everybody in the group gets the same amount of XP per session, more or less. Typically, the group gets XP rewards for things they all do together, with, you know, a little 50 points here, 50 points there for individual skill usage, that sort of thing. Everybody's going to level at different times. And that's what this page has. It has the XP progression tables for all of the different power categories. This starts right away at level 1. Of the standard power categories, an experiment character will hit level 2 as soon as they hit 2001 XP. That's at the low end. Whereas a hardware analytical character or a bionics character, two power categories that are, for my money, not in huge need of mechanical disincentives, those power categories, they don't level until they hit 2401 XP. So they're 400 XP behind an experiment character. And that's just the regular power categories. The Mega Hero power category, which is new to this edition of Heroes Unlimited, I remind you, has an even steeper difference in its XP progression. A Mega Hero doesn't reach second level until 5001 XP, over twice as much as even the hardware analytical character. So all other things being equal, a Mega Hero will take twice as many sessions to reach level 2 as even the slowest progressing of the standard power categories. I'm going to pick out the Mega Hero progression table as the dumbest thing on this page, but only because it really like distills and amplifies what is already a dumb idea about having these separate tables at all. This is one of those days when I'm just like spoiled for options of how to approach this. There's so many ways that this is a bad idea. And these tables are all that's on this page, with no rationale that I can find about why different power categories progress at different rates. So in the absence of a long-winded, you know, trademark Kevin Sambita paragraph about why we do things this way, I just have to guess at what the rationale was, but it can't be good because this is just a bad idea no matter how you slice it. Number one, on a very basic level, there does not appear to be any consistent standard for which characters progress faster than which other characters. If you need proof of that, like the fact that faster or slower progression is not like a meaningful balance factor between different power categories that have different power levels, I mentioned hardware analytical characters, specifically analytical, not weapons experts or vehicle guys, not the rest of the McGee family, but just the hardware analytical character. They and bionics characters are the slowest progressing of the power categories. Already we've got a problem because bionics are underpowered. Hardware analytical is underpowered. However, that's only until level 12, which granted is three levels after the typical campaign would end. But at that point, those power categories suddenly drop from having the highest XP threshold, which means they're the slowest progressing, to being the second lowest XP threshold. In other words, the second fastest progressing. What is the magical thing that happens at 12th level? What lever is flipped that makes it so that the hardware analytical character, who, may I remind you, is an inventor character defined by their lack of special abilities to build anything, that character goes, I guess, from being the most powerful character in the game, theoretically, to being the second least powerful at 12th level for some reason. And there's nothing I can find to back this up. It just seems to be pure whim. The rest of the power categories are similarly inconsistent. I mean, here's another example. Aliens. They're actually one of the faster progressing classes. I think the third fastest progressing, at least at the beginning of play. Remember that aliens have an additional power category. You're not just an alien, you're an alien and something. One of the things you can be is an alien and a hardware character, or an alien and a bionic character. So let's say that you've got two player characters, an alien, some plain Jane government employee who is bionic because she was in a horrible accident, and a bionic alien from the stars. Both bionic, but one of them is an alien too. The alien has all the same abilities and features as the plain Jane human bionic character, except the alien also has a sweet alien ride, a sweet alien weapon, possibly a whole wardrobe of Earth clothes for no extra charge, a bunch of cool bodily modifications for being from exotic planet, plus better bionics than the standard bionic character. And yet, the alien bionic character advances faster because the alien power category has a faster progression. Robotics is even worse, and that maybe takes us to point number two, why this is a bad idea. These power categories vary wildly in not only how fast they progress, but how much they benefit from leveling. For example, magic characters and psionic characters get additional points to spend on their abilities, like additional ISP or PPE, every level, so they get more mojo, and they get access to new abilities virtually every level, if not every level. And many of those abilities scale with level. So on every front, magic and psionic characters get better and better and better every time they level. On the other hand, compared to the robot, robots get almost nothing for leveling up, especially if you've got an AI. Let's say you've got a simple AI, you gain new skills and bonuses to your skills, either not at all or very, very slowly. You don't get new powers. Your existing parts don't scale. You almost get nothing. Like, some robots, I think, literally get nothing for leveling up. And yet, robots and psionics, exactly the same XP progression, which is slower than the mutant XP progression. And mutants may or may not get a lot when they level up. They're human beings, so they learn at the normal rate, so at least their skills get better. And many superpowers get better every level as well. It's like here on the last page, you know, character creation in this game is just a fucking journey. And here at the end, when we kind of like bring all these characters together to see like, how is this supposed to work? How do we level up? We just end up with a fistful of loose threads because there are so many different things moving all the time. Characters benefit to a different amount from leveling. Characters level at a different rate thanks to these tables. Some power categories overlap with other power categories so that, as we mentioned, you can have an alien bionic character. A hardware character who is both an electrical genius and an analytical genius. Hell, you could have a mega hero who is an alien, who is a mutant, who rolls psychic powers. None of that's accounted for here. The supposed power balance of these classes is all over the place. There's no correlation that I can find between being a more powerful class or a class that benefits more from leveling and having a slower progression. It seems to be totally random, but different for everyone. So already we're all over the place with this. We've got all kinds of problems here, but they're really concentrated in the mega hero progression. This is the dumbest thing on this page because of like the final and biggest problem with the XP progression in this game. It is incredibly slow. We know that it's incredibly slow because, as we've discussed in the past on the podcast, the XP section is one place we actually do have a trademark Kevin Sabita explanatory paragraph about how fast you gain levels and why Palladium games have only 15 levels of experience. It is because, and here I quote from page 26 of Heroes Unlimited, "In my original Palladium Fantasy role-playing game playtest campaign, after 2.5 years of regular, weekly, long, average 9 hours playing sessions, the characters averaged 7th to 9th level and were progressing ever so slowly toward 10th level." So we know that if you play Heroes Unlimited for 9 hours a week, after 2.5 years, you would be expected to be between 7th and 9th levels. Even with that information, it might be difficult to figure out how fast characters are expected to advance if your XP rewards kept changing throughout play, as they do, for example, in Dungeons & Dragons. You get different XP rewards for different monsters, so in a higher level campaign, it takes more XP to level, but you also get more XP for each monster that you kill. In Heroes Unlimited, this is not the case. It does take a greater marginal amount of XP per level to level again, so each level comes more slowly than the last, but by and large, XP rewards don't scale. They are flat rewards for having a good plan, playing in character, sacrificing yourself for the greater good, avoiding unnecessary violence, and the rules explicitly say that the major rewards, the XP for killing or subduing a minor menace, killing or subduing a major menace, and killing or subduing a great menace, those are relative to character level. So what determines what is a medium menace versus what is a major menace, that depends on the level of the characters. So those rewards, while they do scale depending on the difficulty, they don't scale on party level. It's not like a high-level party gets to just keep racking up the great menaces because they're high-level and they can take them. It's relative. As a result, we should expect XP gains to be consistent throughout the campaign, no matter what level the characters are. With all this information, we can calculate how fast characters should be able to attain any given level based on their XP progression chart. So I was a little bit curious about Borgen, right? Because mega heroes level slower than anyone else. XP gain is already pretty slow in this game, but mega heroes advance even more slowly than other power categories. So I was curious. Let's say, I mean, I love my poor, dumb, unlikable baby. Let's say that I wanted to play her. Let's say I wanted to go find a campaign and start playing Borgen and see how long it takes me to level her all the way up to level 15, right? player all the way to the level cap, something that is a time-consuming but fun process to do in something like Dungeons & Dragons. However, I can't play at the same rate that Kevin Sambita and his friends did during the initial playtest. I mean, my priorities are all fucked up, don't get me wrong, but they're not fucked up enough for me to fit in a 9-hour role-playing session on a weekly basis as a full-grown adult. 4 hours a week is maybe more realistic for me if I wanted to join a campaign. So I cut down the expected weekly XP gain. I prorated it down to 4 hours a week instead of 9 hours a week. We can fit in about 4/9 as much action per week as in Kevin Sambita's original Palladium Fantasy campaign. And I calculated at that rate of XP gain, how long would it take me to level a mega hero like Borgen from first level all the way to 15th? And the answer is 41 years. Now, I'm happy to report that based on the current United States life expectancy for males, I would barely live long enough to get Borgen to 15th level if I started now. But I want you to consider the fact that there's almost not enough time left in my goddamn life to level a character to 15th level in Heroes Unlimited. I mean, hell, if we start missing sessions for like Christmases, weddings, you know, funerals, people are going to start dying. If we start missing sessions, I might not make it. I might have to call up the group, you know, get on the Facebook group or whatever the future equivalent of Facebook is, you know, put up an angry post on the HoloNet and be like, hey, guys, I'm now 77.5 years old. Borgen just turned 14th level. And as you know, we're expecting it to take about 9 years for her to get from 14th to 15th level. I mean, I understand that you guys got to fly all over the country to be with your great, great grandchildren. You know, many of you in California are moving to evade rising sea levels. But I mean, we've been doing this since 2019. The new century is quickly approaching. I want Borgen to get to 15th level before I die. And if we keep missing Christmases, if we keep missing days for funerals, we're not going to make it. Let's take it as an opportunity. Let's play at the funeral. Guys, come on. I mean, look, I'm not trying to be an asshole. Karen is dead now. She died at 13th level. That's because she was weak. Okay, I said it. We need to be better than Karen. And let's play at the goddamn funeral. You know, let's have some perspective. When I came up with this number, I couldn't believe it. 41 years. So you may be thinking, if you are, you know, an apologist for the Palladium experience system, you're maybe thinking, okay, Kevin Sambita was running 9-hour sessions. Presumably these were pretty shaggy sessions. Nobody does 9 hours of intense tactical roleplay. So probably what happened is that there were like two combats, you know, two scenes where we would expect to get a significant amount of XP, and then a lot of dicking around. If you really wanted to run a weekly session and like most adults, you only had maybe 4 hours to give to it in a given week, you know, at best, it's hard enough to get together people for that length of time, then you would fit the same amount of action into 4 hours. So it wouldn't be so bad. You'd be getting XP at like the same weekly rate, not like half the weekly rate that's suggested in the book. Okay, fair enough. Let's accept that. It's still 20 years. It's still 20 years of your life to get a mega hero to 15th level. I mean, let me put it this way. Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition came out in 1998, 2 years after the popularization of the internet, 3 years before 9/11, 2 years before the Y2K bug kerfuffle, the year Saving Private Ryan and The Big Lebowski came out, okay? If you had bought this book hot off the shelf of your local game store and started playing a mega hero the day it came out, 4-hour sessions every week without missing one, at the XP rate suggested in the book, you would have hit 15th level during the run of this season of MDC. Let's say that back then you were a freewheeling single, right? You know, maybe a college student, 23 years old. That's enough time for you to have a child at 24, raise that child all the way to adulthood to 18 years old when you're 42, and then for them to get out of high school and go off to college about the time that your character is hitting 15th level. That is an absurd length of time to expect someone to play a single campaign of Heroes Unlimited. Certainly on that regular basis. Like, I know there are those people who've been playing in the same campaign since they were in high school, and now every time they go back home to see the friends, you know, every 6 months or a year or whatever, they'll spend a week doing, you know, little gaming sessions every day or like do a long weekend or something like that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about weekly sessions for that length of time. You couldn't possibly have thought for one moment about what length of time this entailed when you wrote these rules. Because if you would have, you would have realized it's ridiculous. Unless, like, I don't know which option is dumber here. Again, we don't have the Kevin Sambita paragraph to explain it. Is it dumber if these tables, as I suspect, were written and no one even thought about how long it would take to get this much XP? And it was just like pure guesswork and just no one did the math and thought like, oh wait, we're talking about decades of play to level these characters up. Or would it be dumber if the author did the math and looked at the numbers and thought, 15th level is really powerful. I don't want them having this kind of power level until, let's say, they've been playing Heroes Unlimited for 20 years regularly. Then after 2 decades of consistent play, we say, okay, you got us. You can have the really good spells now. You've paid your dues. I feel like people must not play according to these guidelines at all. Oh, and by the way, we're not just talking about super high levels here. I mean, it does get to be longer and longer gaps between levels as you level up. But, you know, if you're a mega hero, starting at 6th level, according to the guidelines in this book, already at 6th level, you're going to be gaining less than a level per year of play. And here's what kills me. It's so hard to pick a dumbest thing on this page. That's why I picked like the whole Mega Hero XP progression, because it's just like riddled with problems. I looked for Borg and I thought, let's say I did play this character somehow for 20 and a half to 41 years of weekly sessions. After that last, you know, real hard slog, after that last 4.5 to 9 years waiting to go from 14th to 15th level, what would I finally get at 15th level? What's the payoff? So I looked it up and let me tell you what it is. Borgen would get an additional 3% proficiency at copying fingerprints with her alter physical body power, the ability to increase or decrease her apparent age by an additional 5%, the ability to increase or decrease her height by an additional 2 inches, the ability to add, eliminate, or change one additional birthmark on her body. That's it for superpowers. Her ability to find contraband would increase by 4%. Her ability to prowl would increase by 1%. She would gain +2 to strike and +1 to initiative. Arguably +1 to strike with her energy pistol and energy rifle, depending on how you read the rules, +1 to strike and parry and to throw with a knife, and 1d6 hit points. That's it. After 9 years of waiting, that's what I get for my last level. One more birthmark, 2 inches taller, a handful of combat bonuses, none of which rise above +2, an additional 4% chance to be able to buy drugs, and a 1% better chance to sneak. That's my reward for playing out those last 9 slow years of the campaign, during which nobody else has advanced, by the way, because everybody else's XP progression is already capped. I cannot believe how bad this progression system is. It really goes to show something that is both a strength and a weakness of this game. The fun is really front-loaded in character creation. Like, as much as, you know, filling in all those lines with all those fiddly little skills and percentages can be kind of a pain in the ass, overall, character creation in Heroes Unlimited is really a fun process. It's really where most of the fun is, because combat is a slog, and advancement is largely a choice-free system that takes for fucking ever and doesn't meaningfully improve your character. Oh, and by the way, bonus complaint. Now that we're here on the last page, cast your mind back to all of the stuff that they didn't have room for in this book, like the super genius power category, like any firearms, like all the stuff they dropped from the magic section that was in the previous edition. Here we have one full page taken up by XP progression charts that are actually, tangibly, much worse than just having a single progression chart that could have fit way back in the XP section. It takes a full page of this overstuffed book to implement this idea that is much, much worse than just not having this page at all. And if that is not a perfect capstone to Heroes Unlimited, I don't know what is. Join me tomorrow as we discuss the back cover of Heroes Unlimited and put this book to bed on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today we're discussing the back cover of Heroes Unlimited, 2nd edition, Q Balloons, Q Confetti. We're all done with this book after today. It's the last page. It's not the last episode of the season. We've got one more episode to go, a wrap-up about my poor, dumb, unlikable baby, Borgen, my big pug girl, who we've been creating throughout this book. Tomorrow we're going to finalize her superhero name and her origin and all that stuff, kind of wrap up and complete that character. And that'll be a great day for like final thoughts. And for me to get all heartfelt and give you my earnest podcast voice opinions about how much I love this game deep down, for real. But let's not do that today. You know, it's like the last day of class. It's like you're all going off to college. This is your last day as a senior in high school. All of this is about to not matter anymore. You're receiving what is theoretically your last day of instruction or assessment or whatever. But in fact, who gives a fuck? You don't. I don't. I mean, I have to pretend that I do. I've got to put on my slacks and my button-down shirt and pretend that I showed up for work today. But the reality is, everyone knows this doesn't matter. This page is an afterthought. It's not even a page. It's the back cover of the book. We've said really everything there is to say about Heroes Unlimited. So today, let's just goof off. Like, here's a worksheet, guys. Let's watch a movie, you know? We do have material to goof off because the back cover of Heroes Unlimited contains the following. Number one, an ad for ninjas and super spies. Boring. We've already talked about it. Not only have we already talked about the ad for Ninjas and Super Spies, we've already talked about every single goddamn page of Ninjas and Super Spies back in season one, which, by the way, if you're new to the show, hello, thank you for listening. There is a first season you may not have heard, so during the hiatus between seasons 2 and 3, please feel free to go back and binge season 1. That's what the Megasodes are for. Ninjas and Super Spies was a lot of fun, but I've already said all I want to say about it. except asterisk after talking about transdimensional TMNT and all the offshoots of the TMNT franchise, I do intend at some point to do a special episode where I make a mutant capybara who does capoeira, that special martial art from the Rifter. So we will be revisiting ninjas and super spies at some point so that I can engage in this extremely tenuous wordplay. But other than that, I've said everything I want to say. We also get an ad on this back cover for Palladium Fantasy RPG and for Rifts. All these come with bullet points, with like the top selling points of the game, I guess. And one of them for Rifts is bullet point, incredible power. Which, number one, tells you who they're trying to sell Rifts to. Rifts is for the discriminating preteen gamer who thinks, why make believe being powerful when I could make believe being incredibly powerful? But also, secondly, because I'm bitter, let me point out, you're selling your flagship game on the basis of incredible power. This very game, Heroes Unlimited, used to have unlimited power in it, but you fucking cut it out. Maybe put that on the back cover as a warning. Warning, this game no longer offers unlimited power. You wouldn't do that because you're cowards. People would just buy the revised edition then, so you concealed it from the public. But I've figured it out. By the way, speaking of hurtful and possibly legally actionable omissions and misrepresentations on the back of this book, that brings us to the final thing, the dumbest thing on this page. The back cover of this book has a bunch of bullet points about what you'll find inside Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition, right? These are all the big features to differentiate this book, not so much from other Palladium games, but from all the other games on the market. Back in the glory days of the late 90s, going down to your friendly local gaming store, it was kind of a strange boom period for variety in RPGs. You know, right before D20 showed up and kind of steamrolled everybody, but after the early dominance of D&D, a lot of smaller games were big at that time in the hobby. So you got all these games to choose from. The bullet points on the back of this book exist to tell you, the late 90s gaming customer, why you should choose Heroes Unlimited over a whole bevy of different RPGs. What makes Heroes Unlimited such hot shit? Why should I pick Heroes Unlimited? And there are a bunch of things here that I can't argue with. For example, over 100 super abilities. Yeah, there are. I checked. I did count. It's hard to do an episode about back covers. What do you want from me? Scores of subpowers, over 40 psionic powers, over 100 magic spells, 352 pulse-pounding pages, 32 flavors, 7 special herbs and spices. These are just numbers. They don't mean anything. We got a rundown here of all the different character types in the game. Aliens, mutants, cyborgs, robots, martial artists, wizard experiments, super geniuses, which are kind of in this game, vigilantes, and more, plus the optional mega hero, and they formatted the fuck out of mega hero. Both words are capitalized, it's hyphenated, it's italicized, and it's got a trademark next to it. If I'm being honest, you should read it like mega hero, as in Kevin Sambita is personally disappointed in you for wanting to play a mega hero. But this is all just pretty prosaic, right? This is just numbers, it's just lists. None of this is terribly interesting. There's one bullet point that really caught my attention, though. And this is the dumbest thing on this page. Well, this back cover. Quote, skills, special abilities, fast playing combat, and more. So, okay, you gotta sell your book. But why you gotta lie? why you gotta lie to us? And more than that, like, I don't even think it is a lie, really. I think it is a staggering lack of self-awareness. I was just talking about how this was an interesting time in the hobby, right? There were a lot of games out that had relatively a big market share, right? A big presence in gaming stores, too. And aside from direct competition from other superhero games, there was also just a lot of other stuff going on in the hobby at this time, a lot of other games that were becoming influential and becoming popular. And it's as though Palladium had no concept of them. It's as though Palladium never noticed that there were other role-playing games since AD&D. Because, like, advertising that your game has skills on the back cover. I mean, okay, if this is basic D&D days, you know, if this is early D&D and you're printing this like crudely illustrated zine and you're saying, hey, play our game. It's also got orcs and dungeons just like the other role-playing game, but our game has a skill system. It's what you've been clamoring for in your dank basements and your hobby shops. Across the land, grognards have been stroking their giant beards and thinking, why isn't my character good at anything? Why can't my character do skills other than killing? Wouldn't it be an interesting role-playing experience if a character had a history and personality and therefore were able to, for example, swim well or climb a wall? Those days existed, I guess, right? Because D&D like was pretty rough and kind of came into shape in stages. This is not that, though. This is 1998. Think about what other games are on the shelf next to Heroes Unlimited at this time. Many of them have been around. GURPS has been around. Paranoia, Ars Magica, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying, they've all been around. West End's Star Wars, right? A lot of different stuff. Then in the 90s, you get this boom of additional games that are innovative, right? Amber Diceless is out by this time. Vampire the Masquerade, not just Vampire the Masquerade, virtually the entire World of Darkness line. If you want to know how deep we are into World of Darkness, if you want to know how far we have reached down into the figurative pickle barrel of horror tropes, Werewolf the Wild West, you know, the horror game about that most iconic of horror creatures, the werewolf cowboy, it came out the year before Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition. We're deep down in the fucking well with horror games. Big Eyes Small Mouth is around. An anime game where, I mean, you want to talk about playing fucking robots. Big Eyes Small Mouth, say what you will about it, but it is a game when it tells you you can play a giant robot, you can play a giant robot. Transforming robot, magic robot, whatever the fuck you want. If you want to play a ridiculous robot, Big Eyes Small Mouth is your game. I mean, goddamn, Feng Shui came out a couple years before Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition. In that environment, imagine having the balls to put this game, Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition, on the shelf in the same store as GURPS and say, buy this game. It has skills. Imagine putting this game on the shelf next to Feng Shui and saying, buy our game. It's got fast playing combat. Compared to what? Compared to a fucking play-by-mail game from the 1970s where we're simulating the entirety of the fucking Napoleonic Wars? What by what metric can we say that Heroes Unlimited has fast playing combat? Certainly not compared to other games of its era. This would be like if Big Eyes Small Mouth were advertised as the Big Eyes Small Mouth combat simulation system, and the cover were like World War II war game minis being pushed around on a map of Africa. By the way, speaking of covers, I gotta give a real mention, by the by, to a game from this time that actually was extremely misleading on the cover, the Street Fighter role-playing game, if you're ever able to track it down. It was an interesting White Wolf game, used basically the same mechanics as the World of Darkness system, and the cover of the core book was done in this weird realistic style, like not the art style of the arcade game, nor the art style of the interior of the book, but this strange, like realistic nighttime scene with, I think, like Cammy and Ryu, makes it look like they're about to go cry on a rooftop in the rain about the angst of being Street Fighters. It's very goofy, and it's not a million miles away from what Heroes Unlimited is doing by advertising fast-playing combat on the back cover. The problem with the Street Fighter role-playing game, at least, you know, in the core book, at least on that cover, at least from a marketing perspective, is that White Wolf thought what they had to bring to the table was this, like, hip, edgy, dark, and brooding brand that they could use to spin the Street Fighter franchise into tabletop RPG gold. Quite the contrary. What White Wolf actually had on its hands with Street Fighter was an extremely goofy game, totally, tonally inconsistent with their World of Darkness games, but actually arguably a better fit for their system, and something fun and wacky and goofy to play for fans who, I feel at this point, were probably pretty well saturated with mopey monsters. Like, you know, I love mopey monsters, don't get me wrong. If there's one player character concept I fucking love to play, I can't get enough of, ask my friends, it's horrible people who cry a lot. But Street Fighter was something different, it was something goofy, that's the strength of that game. And the cover betrays either not caring or not knowing that that was the strength of the game, trying to sell it on the basis of something it categorically was not. And the same thing is true of Heroes Unlimited. Although in Palladium's case, I don't think it was like a marketing department. In Heroes Unlimited's case, I think it was the author, I think it was the whole company. I think that Palladium did not, and probably still does not, understand what is good about Heroes Unlimited. I think Palladium is under the misapprehension that Heroes Unlimited is an expansive, fast-paced, no-holds-barred superhero game that allows you to do whatever you want and backs you up with an exceptionally well-thought-out skill system, combat system, and experience advancement system. In fact, all of those things pretty much are garbage. The skills, which are advertised on the back of this book as a selling point, are terrible. Ill-chosen, way too many of them, given to characters in totally the wrong way, and uncustomizable for the most part. I mean, how do you even make a comic book superhero game where you can't spend points or make choices or do anything to be especially good at a particular skill? It's ludicrous. The combat system is terrible, and its flaws are exacerbated by the number of goddamn actions that superheroes get. It takes forever. And for all that this game is called Heroes Unlimited and, you know, theoretically allows you to do anything, like, I mean, you can house rule anything, I guess. But, I mean, the power level tops out way below many, many, if not most, of the most popular superheroes from comic books. You can't do a robot with superpowers. Your magical character options are severely limited. Like, there's a character class for being a firearms inventor, and you still can't invent a fucking firearm. That's how limited this game is. The reason this single line is the dumbest thing in this back cover, for my money, is because with it, Palladium has essentially sifted through 352 pages of content that is, in many cases, compelling and bizarre and kind of demands to be bought and put on your gaming shelf, and they've pulled out virtually the worst things in the game to advertise on the back. They should have let me write the copy for the back cover of this book, you know, assuming that they had like a time machine. I was a tiny boy at this time. Here's what should have been on the back of this book. Big bullet point list. Bam. Random as shit. Bam. Doesn't make any sense. Exclamation point. Bam. Play a stage magician who can't do anything but juggle. Bam. Oh, and by the way, he attacks people with bags full of ashes and dirt. Bam. Play aliens with a totally unsound physiology that'll barely operate in an Earth atmosphere. Bam. Every character is a trained boxer. Bam. No boring social skills. Bam. Basic, essential rules that you'll still be arguing about 20 years later. This game is everything it wants you to believe it's not. It is extremely limited, but extremely specific. It's compelling in its complexity, even though it's slow as fucking molasses. It doesn't allow you to be an immensely powerful superhero. On the contrary, it allows you to be some joker in a cape who's probably going to get killed by a machine gun in the first fight in the campaign, until you wise up and reincarnate to your next player character life as Captain Machine Gun and give the goons a taste of their own medicine. It's just all fucked up, but it's fun. You know what? Forget everything I said before. Two bullet points, all you need. Bam. All fucked up. Bam. Still fun. It's honest, and it's all you need to know. That would be enough to get someone to open the book and flip through. And at that point, you know what? If this is the game for you, you're going to realize that you've found your fucked up gaming home. So that's it for Heroes Unlimited. Join me tomorrow as we wrap up with Borgen and put a big pink pug girl bow on Season 2 on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Today is a special day. We've been talking all season long about Heroes Unlimited 2nd Edition. We've gone through every page of that book. We've gone from the front cover to the back cover, and we've covered the entire thing, identifying the dumbest thing on each page. Along the way, to lend a little bit of context and interest to a lot of the sections of this book, the skill section, the superpower section, the power categories, and so on, I've been making a character. If you've been following along all season, you know that starting at the very beginning with attributes, I've been creating a character, Borgen, my poor, dumb, unlikable baby. Starting all the way from her shitty stats on like day 5 of this season, we've been sticking with Borgen all the way through. Now, in a kind of coda to this season, I'm going to tie all the pieces together, take everything that we know that we randomly generated about Borgen, and just kind of tick off all those things one by one in one big story that ties it all together and gives her a proper origin story, which is, of course, the birthright of all superheroes, no matter how little anyone gives a shit about them. I mean, except Ambush Bug, I guess, but the bar is low. All right, so first things first, before we kind of lay out this whole story of who Borgen is and where she came from and her origin, I want to run down the things we know about her that we either randomly generated or on rare occasion chose from the straight-up Heroes Unlimited character creation process. And then as we go through her whole story that I've created, we're just going to do a little ding sound effect whenever we check one of those off. So here we go. Rapid fire, here are the things we know about Borgen. She was first born in her family. She was, quote, raised by poor laborers in a large alien city. She's a worrywart. She has a humanoid canine body. She comes from a planet with a toxic atmosphere. I won't run down all her attributes, but we have to account for a fairly weak IQ, mental endurance, and mental affinity. We also know that she has the secondary skills of art, swimming, and hunting. She has military skills, demolitions, underwater demolitions, parachuting, and then a few weapon proficiencies, energy pistol, energy rifle, knife, and spear. As part of her military training, she also has some physical skills, boxing and athletics. Her powers come from radiation and were the unexpected side effect of an experiment by a secret medical organization. Those powers are, in addition to her mega hero abilities like supernatural strength, alter physical body, body weapons, mental stun, and multiple limbs. She has espionage skills, disguise, forgery, intelligence, and hand-to-hand assassin. She has middling familiarity with Earth, including 3 Earth languages. She was outfitted for her mission to Earth with an extensive wardrobe of Earth clothes, a large amount of money in Earth currency and precious metals, an energy trident, and hover jet boots. At some point, she ran away from her sponsoring organization that gave her her powers, and we know that she crash-landed on Earth. She has further secondary skills of first aid, prowl, and general repair / maintenance. And finally, this is not a thing we got from the system, but it's a thing we still need to cover, she needs a superhero name. We all know and love her as Borgen, but to hang with Earth's heroes, she's going to need a goofy superhero name. Therefore, we got to give her one. So, all right, with all that in mind, it's time for the secret origin of Borgen. I take you now to Sirius 9, the 9th planet orbiting the 2nd star of the Sirius system. From a distance, it looks blue and otherwise Earth-like, except for orbiting shield satellites that protect the planet from the intense radiation of its star and also, incidentally, from nosy Earth astronomers. It's not the 1960s anymore when we have an alien planet living it up with radio waves and nuclear wars within galactic spitting distance of Earth. We do need to explain why Earthlings don't know about it. A closer look at Sirius 9 reveals an idyllic garden planet dotted by gigantic concentrations of industrial urban development. And these isolated clusters are just smothered under a haze of pollution. These are the production centers, which are gigantic, mostly automated city complexes that supply goods and technology to the whole planet and act as cities to house the laborers who do upkeep for all that production. The divide is dramatic. From the edge of a production center, where the fog of pollution is thinnest, you can see the unspoiled wilderness stretching out to the horizon just outside the city. Like its geography, Sirius 9's cultures are strictly divided. It has two sapient species, both descended from canines, but they diverged long ago. The hybrid, who live in scattered estates all over the garden portion of the planet, resemble anthropomorphic Afghan hounds, the breed of dog that, to my taste, looks most like a privileged asshole. The lowbred, who are equally numerous but really concentrated in production centers, resemble anthropomorphic pugs. The lowbred exclusively service the production centers. They provide the unskilled physical labor to keep the automated cities running. Borgen's story begins 24 years ago when she was born to two maintenance technicians, effectively janitors, and therefore poor laborers, in a production center called Diamond City. They loved their baby, they lavished attention on her, but Borgen struggled in school, and she had a whimsical side that clashed with the workaholic ethos of the other lowbred, who are heavily enculturated to be practical and to focus on work. So she grew into a timid, self-conscious child despite her parents' support. Borgen was happiest when drawing in her sketchbook, that's her art drawing, or on her occasional trips to the country with her family, who would take her to hunt, camp, swim, and run in the open spaces. The lowbred are forced to live in production centers, but they're allowed occasional visits to the countryside as a reward for working hard and keeping their heads down. During one of the planet's many wars, Borgen was drafted to invade another production center across the globe. She didn't like the idea of fighting other lowbred, but she enjoyed the physical training involved in military service, despite her very mediocre aptitude. I imagine that throughout her school career, Borgen raised her hand highest and got picked last for many, many sports. During basic training, which taught her to use a knife and energy weapons, including pistol and rifle, she also learned boxing and mouth disc, which is like football, only it's also fetch. Borgen's preference for taking out machines and infrastructure rather than people, by which I mean dog people, and her difficulty working with others, her shyness, her artsiness, her lack of confidence, these all pushed her strangely toward becoming a sort of marine, which, in her planet's military tradition, is a relatively independent advance fighter who takes out automated defenses prior to infantry action. She was trained in demolitions, including underwater demolitions for attacking production centers on a coastline, trained in parachuting, and the use of the energy trident that Marines favor due to its usability underwater as both a melee and ranged weapon. Notice me sneaking some extra functionality onto that energy trident. There's not even a GM in this situation, and I'm still back on my bullshit. I'm such a veteran at weaseling additional powers for my character through backstory that I just do it uncontrollably. I'm sorry. Borgen served a couple of years without distinction in the conflict for which she was drafted, until a mine that she was disarming detonated prematurely, costing her her arm. Before she could die of her wounds, though, Borgen was rescued by a hover ambulance from Aurum Retrieval Services, a private medical company that provided battlefield medics to both sides of the war. This is where you all boo capitalism. I'll wait. While recovering in the hospital, Borgen was approached by an Aurum representative with a secret offer. An experimental treatment could make her body extremely mutable, mutable enough to regrow her arm with radiation treatment. However, in exchange for the treatment, she'd have to serve in a special military role, in space, where treaties on her planet forbid the military to operate. Despite the obvious shadiness of this offer, Borgen jumped at the treatment and the chance to see space. Let us not judge Borgen too harshly. Imagine if someone offered your dog the chance to go to space. To the extent that your dog could comprehend that possibility, I think your dog would be on board. That's the nature of dogs and the nature of space, okay? So, Borgen underwent an experimental radiation treatment. Her arm grew back, but Aurum's secret goal, which was to transform her into a shapeshifter with telepathic powers, wasn't realized. Her body's mutation grew out of control. The experiment had to be shut down improperly in a big hurry, which left her body unstable for days. When she woke up, her arm was back, but her body had changed in unexpected ways. She could change her fur color, grow taller or shorter, even change her limbs, including her newly prehensile tail, into weapons. She was also vastly stronger and tougher than she had ever been before, or than the experimenters expected her to become. However, attempts to restart and complete the radiation treatment failed. Her body had grown so unstable that they discovered even small amounts of radiation could kill her. By the way, that's her mega hero weakness. I forgot to mention it at the top. That's a bonus ding there. After her recovery, Borgen enjoyed her powers at first, and she dove into her training in infiltration skills like disguise, forgery, intelligence, and even assassin training. She assumed that this training in covert ops was because she'd be engaging in these space missions that her people weren't meant to find out about. However, she soon learned a much darker reason for both her training and the experiment that gave her her powers. Orym was part of a government cabal that intended to use her as one of a handful of invasion spear points to colonize alien worlds. It was sponsoring illegal interstellar flights to find a new world that could be colonized and to which the lowbred could be expelled, leaving Sirius Nine to the highbred who, it turns out, no longer needed laborers to tend to the production centers, and therefore wanted to repurpose the lowbred as a colonizing force. The plan was to send agents who could transform into the shape of the locals, gather information, make first contact, and then use infiltration and assassination to soften the planet up for colonization. Both because of Borgen's great unexpected power, and because she hadn't quite turned out to be the shapeshifter they'd wanted, Orym decided to send Borgen to a world with lots of superpowers and a high cultural propensity to trust a doggy face, Earth. Borgen was prepared with Orym's best, albeit incomplete, intelligence about Earth, including three Earth languages, English, Spanish, and French. She was sent with a wardrobe of Earth clothing, the better to make a good impression, and with a bankroll of Earth treasure and currency. Her mission was to gather information, make first contact, and get in position to assassinate some of Earth's greatest heroes in the event of an invasion. However, Borgen was not comfortable with her orders. Immediately after landing, she attempted to take her landing craft back home to inform on Orym to her own people and blow the conspiracy wide open. Sadly, Borgen does not have much of a poker face, and her handler had taken precautions, shorting the vessel on fuel, so that if Borgen attempted to fly it independently of the agency, as she did, it would run out of power in atmosphere and crash. It did so. Borgen barely had time to grab her survival kit, including her clothing and Earth money, and some emergency jet boots that had been meant for emergency exterior repairs on the ship, when the ship crashed. Borgen was saved from the burning wreckage of her ship by Misha Jackson, an old woman in rural Georgia who'd been up late reading a romance novel when Borgen's ship crashed. Misha nursed Borgen back to health despite her own medical troubles, after which time the quick healing Borgen took over caring for Mrs. Jackson by doing her chores and small home repairs. The two became good friends, and Borgen learned a little more of Earth culture, albeit filtered through novels and daytime television, from Jackson. Borgen made a hilariously abortive attempt to operate in secret in her little Georgia town. I like to think that she ventured out in a trench coat and fedora, like The Thing or the Ninja Turtles, and was immediately mobbed at the supermarket by people who couldn't help noticing that she is a 6'6" anthropomorphic pug. After that, she became a minor celebrity and had no choice but to go public as a super being. When you're the only pug girl on Earth, you've been forced into public view, and you've got superpowers, your best career option is pretty clear. So, in a debut complete with a giant Southern Belle dress, Borgen introduced herself to the human world as Pug-O-War, a walking, fuzzy arsenal who's a little goofy, a little shy, a lot pug, but stylishly dressed and here to serve the cause of justice. What Borgen didn't reveal at her debut, nor to the superheroes who invited her into their ranks, was her original mission to Earth, to infiltrate and assassinate superhero communities very much like the one she was now joining. Finally, back on Sirius 9, Orym Retrieval Services found themselves unable to go public with their vendetta against Borgen. As part of her secret military position, she was officially listed as deceased, and her illegal deployment into space was also purely off the books. Any open search or hostility toward Borgen would have compromised the entire operation. However, Orym does suspect that Borgen might have survived. The medical organization and its shady government benefactors are already preparing an expedition to Earth to retrieve Borgen and clean up her mess by completing the colonization of Earth. Could there be another agent with powers like Borgen's, preparing even now to fly to Earth and take her on? Or perhaps the treatment has worked on future agents, and they've become shapeshifters who are true telepaths, and therefore better infiltrators, as opposed to Borgen, whose incomplete telepathic powers allow her to make mental contact with others that does nothing but stun and disorient both parties. You see how I'm slipping in the possibility that mental stun becomes the much more useful power of telepathy down the line? I can't help it. I'm a menace to GMs and I have to be stopped. These questions about Sirius 9, about the Aurum Agency, we can't answer them now. They would be answered in play. But that's the story up to now. The secret origin of Pugawar. And with that, this season of MDC is done. I'm putting Borgen's final character sheet up on the Instagram. It may be slightly late in going up. I'm recording this like right down to the wire. It just kind of worked out that way, but it'll be up soon. All that remains is to thank you all for listening to this season of MDC. This is still a tiny little podcast, but listenership has definitely grown during this season, and I appreciate everyone who's listened to the show, interacted with the show, told others about it. You may be wondering, especially if you don't follow me on Twitter, what's happening in the future of Mega Dumbcast. The timeline is very hazy still, but here are the basics. We're going to be doing something related to Heroes Unlimited, a short little mini-series, like what I did in between Season 1 and 2, where I went through the Rifter for Ninjas and Super Spies material. It's going to be something like that. It's going to be a short series of episodes, like a few weeks, and I'm going to be using it to raise money to pay for Season 3. I at least need to be able to pay for hosting for another year or whatever it takes to do another book. I probably will try to raise more money for Season 3 than I did for Season 2. Now that I've got a baby here in the apartment, finding the time and space to record a daily podcast is getting much more difficult. There are solutions, but a lot of them cost money, so we'll see how things go. Assuming I'm able to raise the money for Season 3, whatever it turns out that I need, my plan is to do another full Palladium book. I don't know which one it's going to be yet. A number of options have been floated. Villains Unlimited, Beyond the Supernatural, maybe something like Aliens Unlimited. If you've got any recommendations, feel free to send them into the show. Let me know on Twitter, let me know by email. But I'll let you know that I have decided against doing full treatment of Transdimensional TMNT, Mystic China, or Rifts at this time. Three obvious choices that have a lot of appeal, but for various reasons, none of them are a good choice right now. So that's it. Thanks again. Stay tuned, and before you know it, we'll be talking about something else Heroes Unlimited related on a special mini-series of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. Contact or check out the show wherever you want. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. MDC, Palladium Books, Heroes Unlimited, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Sambita. This season's theme song is To the Top by Midair Machine, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org/music/askagain. The Transdimensional TMNT theme, used under a Creative Commons license, is Acapulco 2000 by Jack Fetterman and the In Hi-Fi Music Direction, whose work you can find at freemusicarchive.org. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.